Hey, editing Chris here, and apologies, I didn't realize that I was using the wrong microphone until about 30 minutes into this podcast, at which point a little bit of hilarity will ensue as I realize I've been doing the wrong damn thing. But hey, thankfully the microphone that was recording wasn't too terrible. So yeah, there you go. It's all my fault, and yeah, enjoy this week's episode.
Oh, God. Oh man, you know it's funny because we do have a lot of people, you know, that are always like, "Oh, you should do like an uncut version where you just like let it fly," you know, and that kind of stuff. And we talk about this from time to time and how like we don't want to do that because one, I mean, you've heard we don't cut a lot of what we say, and we probably should. So you kind of have what you're asking for already. Yeah. But you can imagine. If we cut it and it didn't make it on our show,
well, there's two paths, right? There's the like, that's a little too dark, possibly, right? Like, yeah. we've done that. I think the other thing that people don't appreciate is that for all the jokes where they're like, God, that was kind of cringy, there are like 50 more that I have thrown out there that I shotgun out, and Chris goes like, you know, let's keep. Let's maybe not.
The thing is, if it's really funny, we leave it in because we know it distracts from what we're trying to say. And that's constantly the balance. Yeah. It's like, hey, if it's funny enough, leave it in. And so usually we cut the stuff that's so unfunny, it doesn't even meet our very low standards of comedy. So that's 90% of what gets cut.
It's the what is it? It's like, have you ever said something and you're like, that sounded funnier in my head. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Yeah, that happens here.
Yeah.
You know, a lot. So.
Right. We know it's not getting cut. The intro to this episode.
Ooh.
This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020.
That was nice. Yeah, nice segue.
All right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of EMS 2020, the podcast where we review real out-of-hospital calls. And we try and see what we can learn from them. And we try and make it funny along the way. As we mentioned earlier, it's more of an attempt, less of an expected standard, really, than anything. But the audio quality is good, and today it's better because Spencer finally got a new microphone that was actually sent to him. Still doesn't have all the sponsorship crap that's just sitting in it, which actually, at this point, it's more of a cleanliness thing. I should start getting rid of it. I need to make room. What was that famous organizer? Like, does it bring you joy?
Spark Joy, Marie Kondo.
Yeah, absolutely. The stuff that brings me joy isn't set, like, for example, what brings me joy is my Jump Medic kit. My Jump Medic Pro is currently in my car, not stashed in my pile of other crap. So head on over to jumpmedic.com, use promo code EMS2020, to get a little off on your next, I think it's a 10% off, on your next order. The first aid kits are amazing. You can kind of scroll through our Instagram and see some reviews we've done. What I love most is they have a nice, lay flat design where when you open the kit, the whole thing lays out. So you don't have to sit there and like dig into a bottomless pit of supplies to try and grab some random thing and hope that that's what's there. Or do what most of us do, just say, that's missing. Last crew must have not stocked it. But anyway, it also has actual vital sign taking equipment. Unlike the competitors, it actually has a tourniquet, a Cat 5 tourniquet that is approved by the TOCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCCC But anyways, with that, oh, and also the prices are way better, especially when you consider what you get. You get like a pulse oximeter, blood pressure cuff, stethoscope, stuff to actually assess your patient with. So anyway, jumpmedic.com, get yourself a Jumpmedic Pro kit, today. Also, this isn't sponsored. I'm just kind of excited about it. There's a new book for those of you that book. What do they call that?
Eating?
Reading. Reading. Yeah, I can see it here. Yeah. Reading books. So for those of you that like to get your extreme book on, we have just released Advanced Concepts in Critical Care. It's by Ashley and Eric Bauer. I've had the opportunity to read it. Spencer, I don't know if you have, but
I'm waiting for the audio book.
Yeah, because you don't book. Anyway, I don't think there's an audiobook version,
though. Not yet.
Not
but,
yet.
Hey, I'm offering my voice. If you want to hear me stutter through a book, I've got you.
When he's just waiting for the audiobook, he's really just waiting for me to read it to him. That's what it is. But anyway, head on over to flightbridgehead.com and then click on the bookstore. And right at the top, you'll see Advanced Concepts in Critical Care, a comprehensive FPC, CCPC, CFRN, and CTRN book. The book officially ships on October 20th, so you can pre-order now and you can save 15%. So they are limited, signed by the author, pre-release copies if you order now. So flightbridgehead.com, bookstore, get yourself a copy. It's an awesome book. You'll love it. So with that, there's a thing that's going to happen really soon that's super exciting, and I'm bad at secrets, and I don't like keeping them, but I have to keep this one a little bit longer. And it has to do, let's just say it has to do with seeing Spencer and I live from time to time. It's related to that. We're not going on like a rock show tour. I'll say we're not doing that. Well, we kind of are. Well, not really. Yeah. Well, I mean, kind of. It's kind of a thing. Let's just say someone's about to get chocolate in their peanut butter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or peanut butter in their chocolate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Two good things are about to be a really good thing. So, with
unless
that,
you're allergic to peanuts, and then you're like, why did you make my chocolate poisonous?
Or peanuts and chocolate. That would be really bad. But with that, it's. Yes, if. We're good at advertising. That's what I say.
I like how you're trying to, like, you're like, this is a really good thing. And I'm like, unless it's
it
deadly.
It could be poison.
It could actually be lethal, you know?
Oh, goodness. That's kind of like you're either going to get a steak sandwich made with an A5 Wagyu or dog shit. It's, I don't know. It depends. But stay tuned. Check out our Instagram. Check out the Flightbridge ED Instagram as well for some announcements coming up. And it's like coming up as in like next weekish or so. So anyway,
yeah.
With that, Spencer, what do you got?
Yeah, so
I'm sure it's good, or maybe it sucks. I don't know. What call you bringing?
It might
today?
Be lethal. We'll find out.
It might be lethal.
Okay, so before we talk about this call, I want to talk about our last call involving. Addison's, and an Addisonian crisis. So we had a lot of comments. People wrote in saying like, hey guys, I have protocol. Like we have a protocol for this. And their protocols typically have them administering steroids, you know, large steroid doses, medium steroid doses, but either way, steroid doses going to patients, who are, you know, in an Addisonian crisis. And I admit, I probably should have brought that up, that those protocols do exist. So
very cool. A lot of people really like the episode, though.
Okay. I just read all the like, hey, what? Yeah, why didn't you? And it's
well,
fair.
In spite of your failures, yeah. People really liked it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
All right. So with that, I can't wait to disappoint all of you with this one. Here we go.
Oh, perfect.
And by the way, I say that joking because, you know, the audience, our audience is phenomenal and they often do see things that, maybe we missed, maybe we should have said, or maybe we just didn't even consider. And that is really valuable. That is how we also learn. Because, yeah, that's kind of why I do this. I continue to learn things, and I get to make jokes doing it. Some of them good, a lot of them bad. Thank you, Chris, to making me sound better. All right.
Yeah, no worries.
That all being said, let's move on to this week's call. This is a good one. Here we go. This call was submitted to us by a paramedic I'm calling Joe. At the time of this call... Joe had about 2.5 years experience as a paramedic, with most of that time spent at a different agency than the one that this call takes place with. But they've been with the current agency for about 6 months, and they are in an FTEP phase. I do want to point out that this agency that Joe is working for does have a rather prolonged and involved FTEP program. So the fact that they've been in there for 6 months is not unusual. You know, like if where you and I used to work, if someone were in FTEP for 6 months, there'd be like a, going on here? Yeah. But like this is,
I don't think anyone would have made it to 6 months. Honestly.
Yeah.
The way that works is you had 2 months and then you could get put to a third month. And if it didn't happen on the third month, then. Yeah. We found a different spot for you, and it usually was out the door.
Yeah. So,
which, by the way, I'm not saying that's better. I'm just saying that's what it was.
Yeah. So, anyway, this is a typical thing. For this call, Joe is working with a partner I've called Dutch Sibling, a very well-liked and respected FTO paramedic, 15 years or ish. Now, at the time of this call, Joe is under the impression that, you know, for the most part, things are going really well. Dutch has said many times at the beginning of their partnership that, like, man, there really isn't much to do in terms of training. So we're gonna put a pin in that for now. Yeah. No, I love that, too, when it's like, wow, you're a better paramedic than I am. In fact, I'm going to learn from you for the next months.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I used to love that. Be like, hey, tell me what I'm doing wrong. But I will say, since we're putting a pin in this for now, it does make me kind of worry that maybe there is something training-wise to do.
Something wrong with Dutch Sibling? No.
All right.
Okay, so let's talk about the system. This crew work for Caffeinated County Medical Response. This is a large third service agency serving all of Caffeinated County, which Joe describes as essentially a giant urban area with a tiny bit of trees surrounding it. Kind of like a coffee cup. It's black coffee inside is the urban area, and then the rim of the cup is like trees.
Gotcha. So, I will say this episode's theme is pretty apparent.
You just
It's brewed quite strong from the get-go, I would say.
Nice. All right, so this is a huge company with about 65-ish ambulances on over a 24-period time. That, of course, doesn't mean that all of them are available. I think that's more of a, we would like to say that we have 65 ambulances on in this period of time. But gotcha. Staffing, of course, being what it is, and that's, you know, seems to be universal. So,
very true.
This
is a huge company then.
Yeah. This system uses a dynamic deployment model, commonly called system status, and the crews typically work 12-hour shifts and are staffed medic EMT. Although, again, like there are a handful of shorter or slightly longer shifts, but the majority is 12 hours. This is a busy service with crews running about 8 calls in a 12-hour shift, and I think that's specifically this crew's shift. It's a day shift, so I don't know, like, the night shifts. I doubt the night shifts are running 8 calls in a 12-hour period. I hope they're not running 8 calls in a 12-hour period.
That would be a hard day.
That would suck. So we'll talk about hospitals as we get into the call. There is a fire department, but they don't factor into this call, so we'll just kind of leave that one alone. The only thing worth noting in this system is that, and this system, like several others, utilizes community paramedics. Now, in this particular system, the community paramedics can be used to respond to calls where an alternate destination protocol can be used. So basically, like, if you have a patient who doesn't quite, it's like they don't really need an ER, they need mental health services or they need addiction services, then a community paramedic can respond and evaluate the patient and make sure that they can be transported to those alternate destinations. Additionally, they can respond to critical calls and assist crews there. I do believe they have a slightly more expansive protocol in things that they can do. So I think that is really all we need to know about the system. Any questions before we proceed?
I know you said that the fire department, not a huge deal in this particular call, but I am curious, and you might have said it and I forgot, what are the capabilities clinically of the fire department? Should they, because, you know, even if they don't respond to a call, sometimes it's a point of discussion of whether or not we should have asked for them, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I didn't ask because I don't really think it factors too much into this call.
At
the time they were included and disregarded, I don't think it would have mattered. But we can get into it, and you can be like, hey, man, I think it matters. And then I can say, yeah, I didn't ask. I don't know.
Okay, perfect. Alrighty. Well, no, with that, my only question you are completely incapable of answering. So, yeah, that'd be dope.
I'm glad I could start with disappointment.
Ah, perfect.
All right. So speaking of starting, our call starts mid-shift at midday. Joe and their FTO Dutch sibling clear a hospital and immediately get tapped to respond to a local urgent care for a 39-year-old male reported to have an altered mental status.
Ooh.
It's worth noting here that this call has been holding for a bit of time at this point. Urgent cares or other facilities where, like, there's medical staff, I think, like, doctors, those requests come in secondary to primary scene calls. So I guess here is that this is probably due to that there is a provider already on scene and, like, they are doing medical care, whereas there probably isn't a doctor and some nurses, like, on a street corner stabilizing a patient. That, I believe, is really sort of the reason behind this particular pattern in this system. But either way, it's something that's in play. And I imagine that there's probably exceptions, like in the case of, like, hey, you're at an urgent care, and they're like, this guy's having a STEMI. I doubt the ambulance is being like, well, there's a guy with a code 1 sick person at this house, so we're going to go do that.
So these are treated almost as like an elevated transfer, like not quite a scheduled transfer, but not quite a 911 call, more like a when the resource is available, send it kind of thing, unless, of course, special conditions apply.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to describe it. So,
okay.
So Dutch and Joe go lights and sirens towards this clinic. They don't talk much as they go en route because Dutch, the FTO, isn't really much of a talker. And Joe says that they spent the drive time like trying to catch up on their charts because it's been a busy day. It's a 20-minute trip to the urgent care, and at about 5 minutes out, they get an update from dispatch. The patient is now unresponsive and has a heart rate in the 40s. And now, a fire response is being added, along with one of the community care paramedics. So, they arrive to the urgent care center. This is a standalone, single-story building. The crew park out front, with the fire department arriving shortly behind them. The crew load up their gear onto the stretcher, and they take it in. And their gear is essentially, like, they have a primary kit, their cardiac monitor, and they have an O2 bottle. And their primary kit is described as, like, having everything you would need in the first 10 minutes of any call. So it's stocked precisely for whatever you might find. You can at least start providing care there before needing to, like, go get other supplies or move the patient out to the ambulance.
Gotcha. Which becomes a problem if your patient is stuck or in a prolonged situation.
Yeah. Then you go fetch my 30-minute bag.
Crap, it's going to be an hour. Get the hour bag. Yeah.
All right. So point is, it's really the only bag that they need to bring in here. They enter through the front doors and head into the lobby and are directed by staff towards the exam room where their patient is. Joe and Dutch enter the room and find the following scene. There is a 39-year-old male, a patient who is laying supine on an exam bed in jeans and a t-shirt with bits of shrubbery stuck to their clothes.
Okay.
The patient is estimated to be about 5'11" and weigh 170 pounds, or 180 centimeters and 77 kilograms. There are three nurses and one doctor all in this exam room. There is a nurse up at the patient's head, a nurse on a step stool, standing and kind of hovering their hands over the patient's chest as if about to do CPR, and a nurse down by the patient's legs, holding them up, like elevating the legs above the patient's body.
Good for her. Yeah. There you go. Number one intervention right there.
And then the doctor is standing as they should at the foot of the patient, directing all of this. The patient is noted to be on a pulse oximeter and have a BP cuff on, and Joe could not remember their values, but what Joe does notice is that the patient's skin appears like they're perfusing. But regardless, like, the patient is clearly unresponsive, and so in that sick, not sick differential, you know, where it's like, are they sick, not sick, is this a critical patient, potentially critical patient or not? They're like, well, right. They're unresponsive for no reason that we know of. Like, yeah, so they're sick, but their skin looks
good. Sick. Yeah, there you go.
All right, so Joe and Dutch move in to assess the patient. The doctor, Dr. Green, tells the crew that the patient was seen by the staff stumbling outside the clinic, and they watched him fall into the shrubbery. The staff... It's a fun word, shrubbery.
It is, and yeah. I should, yeah, there's no reason to laugh at shrubbery.
It's, yeah, it's very Knights Hussein-y, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. That was it.
Yep.
Yep.
Shrubbery! All right.
That's the one.
This is so dated. Like, people are, there are 30-year-olds who are like, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
No, 100%.
I'm disappointed in all of you. All right. So the staff see him fall into the shrubbery. The staff bring him inside, and they found him to be alert initially, but then they say, like, his condition has only gotten worse since then. So let's go to their assessment. Level of consciousness, the patient is alert to painful stimuli, and by that I mean their eyes open, and they kind of withdraw from it, and they groan. Airway. They didn't check the airway. The patient was breathing, but they didn't open the patient's mouth. And in an altered mental status patient, probably a good idea, because even if they're breathing, there could be, that could change if they have something in their mouth. Breathing is described as normal respirations, and they check a radial pulse. It's strong, probably mid-50s. The skin color was good. The patient is clammy, and they do check pupils real quick and note that the pupils are not pinpoint. So, Chris, what are you thinking here? What's on your differential, and what would you like to see happen on scene?
Oh, boy. So everything's kind of on my differential at this point. So I'm going to compliment them first. This is a good initial look for immediate life threats assessment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, hey, LLC, ABC, we don't need to, we're not going to be intubating this guy. They're breathing. We got the LLC down. And then the circulation, mid-50s, strong and radial. So that's good. Skin color's good, but the patient's still kind of clammy. Pupils are not pinpoints. That's a good check there. Now, I just want to verify my history here. He was seen stumbling through the shrubbery outside, and they brought him in, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this is essentially a scene call at this point. Even though it's in an urgent care, it's a scene call. It's not like set where you'd be like, oh, can you print off the patient's history? You know, there's a lot of differences here. And so I think we got to go into this with the scene call mentality, and that, you know, we don't know, which we should be on every call anyway. But
yeah.
This is a classic altered LOC, and so I kind of want to do my classic things. So at this point in the assessment, I don't think there's any immediate interventions that need to be done, but all that means is that we need some immediate assessments to be done. So I would want to know, I like to start with fuel. Is fuel getting to the brain? What's the patient's blood pressure? I'm going to suspect that the blood pressure is probably okay, since we have a strong radial in the 50s. And we also need to check the oxygen level of that fuel. We need to make sure that fuel's got some sugar in it. So I'd want to know those three things off the bat: blood pressure, oxygen saturations, and then CBG. The thing about this, though, is I'll tell you off the bat, although I'm definitely going to check those things because I don't want to make assumptions and miss something, a heart rate in the 50s with a good strong radial pulse is kind of leading me away towards this being like a fuel or a hypotension issue.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see what the sugar is. I'm really curious to see what the blood pressure is, because I'm really concerned as we go into my next category. So yeah, first thing is like, hey, Is it fueled? Okay, yeah, it may be fueled in this case. The next thing is like, all right, is it broken? We have a guy stumbling around outside, so trauma is certainly a consideration. You know, we don't know how many times this guy fell before he made it to the shrubs, right?
Yeah.
You know, that could have been the initial thing. Maybe he tripped and fell. Maybe he's assaulted and went to the nearest place looking for help. So we need to make sure we do a good head-to-toe on this guy and look for signs of trauma and ask, just simply ask, like, hey, you saw him falling in the shrubberies. He didn't also, like, fall on the concrete, did he? You know, or anything like that. And the next thing is like, hey, let's start thinking stroke. And another thing we're going to look at that's going to cover both trauma and stroke is, especially when we're talking like a lower end heart rate like that, is do we start having these signs of Cushing's triad going on? Are we going to have an elevated blood pressure accompanying this with a low heart rate? You know, because we have a broken pipe somewhere, either through a non-traumatic mechanism, atraumatic bleeding, you know, like a CVA, or do we have it through trauma? Because in both of those cases, what'll happen is you'll spring a leak, you get a leaky pipe up there, and it starts to, you know, bleed, and certain areas of the brain aren't getting the fuel that it needs. And so the brain makes this super incorrect assumption that it's, well, clearly, I need more pressure to get up here. So it does things that it does to try and get more blood pressure up to itself. But the problem is over time, what'll happen is that will actually start to herniate. And that means the brain will start getting pushed out the foramen magnum, which is the hole the brain stem goes through and connects to the spinal cord. And what you start seeing at that point when that happens is you start getting compression on the cranial nerves, the vagus nerve being one of them. And you start to see a slowed heart rate. Also, centers that control respiratory rate will start to become dysregulated. So you get these kind of abnormal breathing patterns as well. So the breathing seems normal for now, but I'm really curious to see about, is it broken kind of stuff? And I want to know that, like I said earlier, like what's that blood pressure? What are those sats? What's that sugar? The other thing too with stroke is, you know, when the patient moves and they withdraw, are we able to see if they withdraw from each side equally? So yeah. You're not going to be able to have this guy, like, are you going to be able to have this guy complete a stroke screen? Probably not, because it doesn't sound like he's able to follow commands. But can we see if he responds to pain on one side over the other? Like, is there any favoritism going on? Is his gaze preferential to one side or the other? And then after that, we need to start looking at things like possibilities for sepsis and intoxicants and those kind of things. And with sepsis, we would expect someone to be tachycardic and tachypneic. As part of that with a potential fever, which we can kind of feel with our hand through the skin, or if they actually have a good thermometer at this place, we could use that to try and help. And you'd also want to try and identify a potential source for that infection as well. Anyway, those are my thought processes going on. So no immediate interventions now because we haven't assessed enough. So let's move on to the assessment. Let's see what they do.
Okay. So the patient gets moved from the exam bed to the EMS stretcher via a sheet transfer. And upon arriving to the EMS stretcher, the patient becomes noticeably alert and in fact starts trying to get up and off of the stretcher. Dutch and the now on scene community paramedic Arizona, last initial T, helps direct the patient to stay on the stretcher and secure the patient to that.
Okay. Is the theme just things you hate?
No.
Is that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Sorry, yeah, absolutely not. So how are Dutch and Arizona T doing again? What are they doing right now?
Well, so Dutch sibling.
Dutch sibling.
Yeah.
Certainly not Dutch brother.
No, it's Dutch sibling. It's different.
Yeah.
And gotcha. Arizona T, it's last initial T, like no relation to the can of mouth sore that
My
raspberry iced
tea.
The raspberry specific flavor induces no, this is just T, like for Thomas.
Okay.
Arizona Thomas. I think you're kind of reading into this a little too much. Yeah. All right.
Obviously, I'm the problem here.
So if I didn't mention before, the fire department arrived kind of shortly after the ambulance did, and they're staged outside.
Hey, Spence, does this sound different now?
Yeah.
Does it sound better?
It does sound different.
Yeah. Yeah, I was using the wrong microphone for that last half hour.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen.
I know. This is normally not a me problem. And the worst part about this, guys, is I'm normally like on everybody else for like their microphone settings. And because I'll just sit there in anguish and watch other people being like, All right. Do I need headphones for this? Yes. The answer is always yes. And then they set up like some terrible microphone, or they'll have their microphone in front of them, but they're using their inbuilt microphone and they don't know how. And here I am doing exactly that thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a listen.
I feel like my 10 minutes of trying to figure out why my microphone wasn't working, because the power wasn't on, probably sabotaged you in some fashion, because you were.
Yes.
Trying to solve
that's definitely it. Gosh, it's your fault. How terrible.
You know, if you gave me my stuff, I wouldn't have to sabotage you. But
if I gave you you want boxes of bad energy drink powder to mix in?
No.
Which, by the way, with as much coffee as been thrown around this episode, I feel like Medic Grinds they didn't pay for it, but they're good guys. So yeah, check out Medic Grinds if you like coffee. There you go. And energy drinks. They have new energy drinks out. MedicGrinds.com. Promo code EMS2020. 20/20 actually on that one. They actually have the slash as part of the promo code.
All right. So where were we before you profoundly disappointed me?
I don't remember.
Okay. All right. So then to recap.
Were you here?
Yeah, right. To recap, they move the patient over. The patient becomes more awake, confused.
Ah, yes.
They get the patient to sit in the stretcher. They secure him with straps. And Dutch and Arizona take the patient out to the ambulance. So while that's happening, Joe stays to get more information about the patient from the doctor. Because remember, at this point, they've essentially been like, yeah, we saw him wandering outside. He fell into our bushes, and we can't have that. So we brought him inside. Now, there's another thing that happened before we get to what the doctor said that I think is really important to bring up. When the patient got moved to the stretcher and suddenly woke up and started, you know, kind of like trying to get up and stuff, Joe thought for a brief moment that he noted some right facial droop. But it was one of those, like, when he kind of looked, he's like, is that? And then he took a better look and he's like, no, it's not there. Huh. But no one else seemed to, like, notice it or comment on it. And again, it kind of vanished as quickly as he saw it. So he's not really sure what he saw there. But anyway. So Joe talks with Dr. Green. It's Dr. Green Thompson. Different, no relation to Arizona.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. This is not green tea at all. Gotcha. No.
And one of the RNs. Joe learns that they are actually very familiar with the patient, a Mr. Earl Gray. it's Earl Gray Hot, like Gray Hot, you know, like hyphenated.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. Okay,
Earl Gray Hot. He's been in the clinic many times, and he does have a history of drug addiction, an IV drug use. The RN tells Joe that they believe that this is some kind of overdose. Like, this is he's gotten into some kind of drugs. He's clearly overdosed. And the doctor says that they actually suspect the presentation is due to a recent medication change that they made for the patient the last time they saw them, a week or two ago. The patient was told to stop taking Subutex and start taking gabapentin. And note for the listeners here, Subutex is a medication that can help ease symptoms of opioid withdrawal as well as treat pain. And gabapentin is used to treat pain believed to be neurogenic in origin. Hey, it's not your bone that's broken or like you have a muscle tear or ligament tear. This is like neurogenic pain, like neuropathy from diabetics commonly will take this for neuropathy where the nerves hurt and fire off because of reasons.
There's a lot of diabetes chief among them. That'd be another one where you come and see this medication.
So with this information, Joe heads out to the ambulance and finds Dutch Sibling and Arizona T sitting in the ambulance with the patient who is now sitting up and remaining alert. As he enters, he hears one of the two medics telling the patient, I think you took some drugs today. You can't seem to answer our questions. I'm adding the inflection that I heard in my head when this was told to me. So,
Okay.
It could be different, but I don't think so. And for his part, Earl is speaking in slurred words, and does like occasionally start to answer questions and would just sort of trail off when responding, or they would start to answer coherently only then to start saying things that like really don't make sense in the context of the conversation. These responses and sort of his overall demeanor, only seem to further reinforce the belief that Dutch and Arizona seem to share that the patient has taken a concoction of drugs, and or alcohol. And Dutch starts listing off names of various street drugs and telling the patient to nod if he's done them. While this is happening, Joe gets the patient on the monitor and takes a blood sugar. So here's what we have. So for level of consciousness, the patient is alert, but responding in inappropriate sentences, I think, is the best response. So GCS is 4, 3, and 6. So 4 is the spontaneous eye opening. 3 is for inappropriate words. And 6 is that they obey commands, simple commands.
Yeah.
Their blood pressure is 126 over 82. The heart rate is 56 sinus rhythm, 98% on room air. They are respirating at 18 a minute. They have a blood sugar of 112 milligrams per deciliter or 6.22 millimoles per liter and a tympanic thermometer reading of 100.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Now, Earl seems to get angrier over the course of the questioning by Dutch and Arizona and finally just stops responding and instead just stares straight ahead and refuses to like talk to Dutch. Or Arizona. A comment is made that the patient is talking out of his head, which I looked it up what that phrase means because I think I know, but you know, like colloquialisms and whatnot. And the Urban Dictionary says saying senseless, unintelligible, silly, or crazy shit due to a lack of sleep, intoxication, or general stupidity. So that is what that means. Joe brings up that they noticed some brief facial droop in the exam room, which isn't there now, but they said, hey, guys, I think I saw this. Could this maybe be a stroke? So Dutch goes like, okay, yeah, maybe, and tries to get Earl to participate in a stroke exam. But Earl is riding the, like, hey, you go fuck yourself train, and doesn't comply.
Choo-choo.
Joe, kind of seeing that this isn't going anywhere, sees an opportunity to move the call forward and says, like, hey, guys, why don't we just start going? They ask Dutch to take them to the closest hospital, French Press Medical. Arizona T departs the ambulance to return to be available in the system, and Dutch gives up front to drive. Now in the back alone with Earl, Joe takes a different approach. They ask the patient if they remember what happened, if they hurt anywhere, if they're dizzy, etc. They ask the patient if they can do a 12 lead and ask Dutch to, like, hey, hold on 1 second so they can get that done. Joe says that Earl would start to respond, still slurring or, as Joe called it, speaking in cursive, which is how I will forever now describe slurring patients. Because here's the thing about cursive. I know that cursive has some benefits, like some neurocognitive fucking benefits, but it is the slurred speech of handwriting. I have to squint to make sense of it, just like my ears have to squint to make sense of slurred speech. Why does your S look like a fancy D or an ampersand? It doesn't need to. Honestly, like, if you have poor handwriting and you're writing in cursive, that is the
worst.
It's just incomprehensible in all, and there should be some kind of punishment by law.
And so much of it is just like, I recognize the capital letter. And by the way, many people who frequently write cursive, you'll see it like T, for example. The T is going to be a printed T. It's not the cursive T, which looks like a weird something you'd see on like a sheet of music. It's just a capital T, squiggle line, squiggle line, squiggle line. And if there's T's or I's throughout, they'll put dots and T's there. So you have the look of a word and that's it. And that's what cursive 90% of the time.
I feel like to read cursive, it's mostly maybe the neurocognitive benefit is that you have to kind of guess what the word is via context. And so it's kind of a puzzle. Maybe that's it. I know it's not. I tried to go off this rant with my wife, and she made a point that, like, actually it is better. It's been done. And I'm like, I don't want to hear how good it is.
Yeah, I want to hear your facts.
Don't bring your facts to my feeling, right?
Yeah. What are you thinking? Yeah.
So anyway. He's speaking in cursive. Going back to the call, Joe notices the same pattern that he saw with Dutch when Dutch and Arizona were interacting. Earl would start to slur out or cursively speak a coherent response, but then stop or say things that just didn't quite make sense. Like the wrong words, it made the conversation kind of unintelligible. Joe also notices that Earl seems to get frustrated in these moments. And he kind of says it was like he just physically couldn't get the right words out of his mouth. So, Chris, in non-cursive speech, what would you think of this call so far? What do you think's going on? And what would you want Joe to do?
I kind of hate this call a little bit. So there's a couple things really quick. What's our ETA to the nearest hospital?
So the nearest hospital is probably about 15 minutes away.
Okay, and that's the one they're going
that
to.
That is the one they intend to go to, yes.
What are the capabilities of French Press Medical?
So that is a primary stroke center.
Okay, so that's the right place to take this patient. So this is the hard part. And it's super easy from like an educational standpoint just to be like, well, we should, be treating this as though it's a stroke and go code 3 with a stroke activation and all those things. Yeah. Like that's the worst thing that could be happening with this guy. And to say like that's what should be done. So I'm going to say this, that is probably what needs to be done here. There's a couple things I want to back up on. And that is that I'm disappointed that we had one clinician stay inside and question the doctor and talk to the RN, which I think is totally fine. I don't see a problem with that. But the other clinicians who loaded the patient didn't really seem to do anything until Joe got there, which given I understand that's probably a small amount of time. Sounds like Joe just got kind of a recap of what happened and some info. But I have to admit, if I was Joe and I popped back into the ambulance and saw that I just had two partners who were just accusing the guy of taking drugs and like no vital signs are taken yet, the CBG isn't done, the patient's not on the monitor, I'd be like, hey guys, why don't we do that? I think one of the hard parts about this is that we don't have the patient's compliance and we lost that early on, and that's going to kind of inhibit our assessment going forward. I would have loved to see this guy complete a stroke scale.
Yeah.
But it kind of seems like he doesn't want to, because we kind of started with and here's the thing in Chris Finkson's, chain of stuff, the check for an altered, LOC, intoxication is on there, and it is a valid concern. It's a valid clinical route to go down. But we don't really want to start there, and I do my chain in a specific order for a reason. And the problem is that imagine you're this guy. And you have a history of addiction, and maybe you don't have the best social skills anyway, because I don't know this guy, but maybe that's just I'm not saying that addicts don't have the best social skills. I'm just saying maybe this guy doesn't, and he's an addict. Yeah. So he's dealing with addiction. You're probably used to people accusing you of being drunk and high a lot because, hey, maybe you've earned that in your struggles with addiction. But now imagine you're having a stroke. And without assessing it, and you're trying to speak to people because, this guy seems to be having trouble getting words out, but he otherwise seems to be kind of responding, right? Yeah. Like, he seems to be understanding what people are saying. He seems to be following commands. It just seems that he can't pick and choose the right words, and so he has these inappropriate words. And so to me, if this was purely a drug problem, and I think Joe's getting the same gut feeling here too. If this was a drug problem, and I had someone that had a specific level of alertness and they were slurring their speech, I would say this seems to follow the more the intoxication route. But because we seem to have a pretty fair level of alertness now, where the patient's alert and looking around and talking and actually being obstinate, not want to do what's being said anymore. Those parts seems to be functioning. We're not seeing slurred speech.
we're getting inappropriate words. And so that really starts to drive me more towards like, oh, this doesn't sound like an overdose necessarily anymore. It could always be two things. That's the other option, right? It could always be two things. Someone could be like, God, I have a massive headache. Let's wash it down with some alcohol. That's always possible.
Yeah.
While I can see a lot of people falling into that trap of here's a guy with an addiction history, the clinic just told us it was an addiction issue, a lot of this seems to fit the drug thing. I'm getting the feeling that Joe has a gut feeling this is more. I think Joe is right. I think you should act on that gut feeling. And so I think that the main treatments here is O2 monitor, IV, get to the nearest stroke center.
Yeah. All right. I do want to make something clear because it's worth saying that there may be some mannerisms that we weren't there. So I can't see the way that the patient fully presented to Dutch and Arizona that made them go like, this seems drug like related, other than like the patient's history, right? So there may be some mannerisms that they additionally picked up on that I just didn't capture. I want to give that. I just want to make sure that I'm making that clear, that that is a possibility, not to excuse, but to potentially just further paint a picture that maybe they picked up on something that I just, you know, like I didn't capture here that drove them more towards that. But
fair. But none of that, while that would make skipping a baseline assessment understandable.
Yeah.
It makes it a more understandable mistake. It does not make it an excusable mistake.
Exactly.
Because even if it is drug related, those vital signs are still important. And so to kind of sit back with two of you doing nothing, even if it was just for like 5-6 minutes, well, I mean, you know, 5-6 minutes could really matter.
They weren't doing nothing. They were interrogating the patient, you know.
No, fuck me. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Never mind. I take it all back. Now, so anyway,
I think you bring up a really good point. And I do want to make a thing here is that, you know, like the patient wasn't compliant with the previous providers. And, you know, understandably so, because I could see myself also on the like, yeah, go fuck off train. Even if the thing that may have been helpful, you know, like participating in a stroke assessment may have been beneficial. People don't always do things that make logical sense but it makes emotional sense. And you know, go fuck yourself is a very strong, and like that makes a lot of emotional sense to me in this regard.
Now when you say not cooperating with the previous providers, do you mean the urgent care staff or do you
mean
our two medics in the ambulance?
I mean Dutch in Arizona, but Joe is a different provider here, and he has taken a different approach, and he's been able to do things like a 12 lead. Joe, seeing Earl struggle to speak, says, I don't think you did drugs, and I am sorry that they talked to you like you were, but I don't think you are. Earl shakes their head no and starts trying to talk, but it's just less coherent. Joe, thinking quick, asks the patient if maybe they could write down what they want to say, and Earl says yes. So Joe grabs some paper and a pencil and gives it to the patient to write with, and I'm assuming like on a clipboard. And Earl writes the following sentence. My mind is appropriate.
Oh, wow.
A full refutation of the, he's talking out his mind statement.
Yeah. Very well.
So Earl says, Earl then in full cursive speech says, I think I'm having a and Joe offers, stroke? And the patient says, yes. Joe asks Earl if they know what time this started, and Earl writes down a time. That was about 3.5 hours ago. He writes that he made sure to remember the time because he knows about strokes and time being important.
So what we're saying is Earl's the best clinician on scene so far. I'm kidding. I'm just, good work, Joe. Good work.
So Joe goes to alert the hospital. French Pest Medical, this is caffeine in a can, unit 1. French Pest Medical comes back and says, be advised that we are on red and on divert. So Joe tells them to disregard and tells their FTO to divert to the next closest hospital, which is also a stroke-capable center, Leaf Broth Medical, and tells them that, hey, this is going to be a stroke alert patient, tells Dutch.
Yeah.
Dutch asks, are you sure? And Joe says, yes. Dutch responds with a, okay, if that's what you want to do. Okay, I want to make a point here as a former FTO. The correct way to handle this situation from the FTO standpoint, in an FTO trainee relationship, is to ask them why. Don't.
Yeah.
Hey, what changed? Like, what are you? Hey, what are you seeing that I wasn't, that I'd missed? You know, or did something change? Ask them why. Don't. Don't give them this passive aggressive fucking bullshit. That is
okay.
That is called being an asshole. God. And listen, I have been an asshole to partner. Like, really, you want to do okay? But I know. But when you're in especially in this relationship as an FTO trainee, where it's your job to train somebody. Don't do this. Yeah, that's
no. This is a terrible way to do things.
So
yeah.
All right. More on that later. The next hospital is about 15 minutes away, and the transport is now lights and sirens, which means the total transport time for this patient was about 25 minutes. The patient's condition remained unchanged, and the patient's vitals en route stayed relatively similar. Blood pressure's between 133 and 119 systolic. The heart rate went up, actually, and kind of just stayed in the 70s. Joe got an 18-gauge in the left AC and drew blood labs as per their local protocol. The patient continued to communicate. Jesus Christ.
Really quick, Mr. Cursive Speech. Turn your camera on, and I want you to go ahead and hold both your hands out like you're trying to hold a giant plate up.
No. No. You can go fuck yourself.
I'm on
that train. All right. The patient continued to communicate primarily through writing, and while most of what they said was cogent, some of what they wrote also didn't seem to make sense. And I do want to make a point that Joe never actually did a secondary stroke assessment. They've picked up on this, and they have determined that this is a stroke, and it didn't really occur to them to try and do another assessment. They haven't noticed any other deficits, but they also didn't really look more. They're kind of like, yeah, I have what I need to make this determination. And they use a BFAST or VANS stroke assessment, and speech is a part of those. So that may be all that they needed anyway. Yeah, more on that in a little bit. On arrival to Leaf Broth Medical, the patient was taken into a large emergency department bay, and Joe gave them report, and they were thankful that Dr. Chai at the ED bedside took their concerns seriously. The patient went down to CT, and Dutch decided to follow along, and Joe went out to the ambulance to chart, slightly disgruntled about the experience. So I do have follow-up, but let's review what happened first.
So Dutch and Joe get dispatched to an urgent care for an altered mental status patient that was gallivanting about in the bushes. They arrive to find a 39-year-old male with clinical staff attending, and the patient, Earl Grey, wakes
Earl Grey
up
hot.
When moved to the stretcher. Earl Grey hot wakes up when moved to the stretcher, but appears confused and tends to speak in cursive. So Dutch, Arizona, and some of the nursing staff think that the patient may have used drugs, and the doctor at the clinic thinks that this may be like a medication reaction because they recently got rid of Subutex and replaced it with gabapentin. Dutch and Arizona take the patient onto the interrogation chair. I mean, the ambulance, and have really seemed to focus in on this intoxication idea, and in lieu of doing any other kind of assessment. Joe finally gets the patient alone, and using a pencil and paper, determines that the patient is likely to be having a stroke. Which, by the way, I love that move.
Yeah.
The transport is upgraded with an "Are you sure you want to do that?" kind of response from Dutch, which is shitty. And in conclusion, I'm really hoping Spencer will reveal that he was sure that he wanted to do that, because there's a big old clog in the pipe or a burst pipe. I mean, I don't want this guy to have a stroke. What?
I kind of want him to have a stroke, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, I want the care to have been appropriate for what was going on with them. Really quick question for you, Spence. Was there much of a time difference between the two hospitals?
So it would have added, it added, I think, probably about like 10 more minutes, to okay. that. And that actually is something that when we get into that particular portion, I do have questions about that. Cause I think you Same. Are, probably better to talk about typical, like, hey, when a hospital says they're on divert, et cetera.
Yes.
So,
and it will change depending on where you're at. But yes, I have some things that I would love to bring up. But I want to look at a couple of things. I of course want to look at this guy, you know, clinically.
Yeah.
I also want to take a look at the FTO dynamic.
Mm.
I think that's a big thing that we really need to touch on. As well as
I have more
as the clinical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I definitely have some FTO things that I want to talk about, and more that I have yet to reveal here. I think it's worth talking about aphasia as well. And, you know, and then, you know, doing the rest of what we do, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So let's.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's start with the potential system problem, and now we are going to unpin a previous thing. And I do want to say I debated whether to bring this up, because as mm-hmm. some of what I want to talk about falls outside of the parameters of this call itself, and I try to kind of limit things to the parameters of the call, like to the confines of the call, you know, but. Also, in this situation, I'm basing what I want to talk about off of, you know, one person's telling without hearing the other side. And that also was a factor here.
Absolutely.
But Joe's experience in talking with me mirrors that of many others that I have met throughout my EMS career who have, you know, found themselves in this situation during their FTEP period. So I think regardless of the dynamics of this particular situation, this is an issue that needs to be talked about and addressed anyway, because I think it's a net benefit to everybody. And that is one of communication. So the backstory with this partnership, and again, it's, you know, it's one side, right? There, you know, I have not heard the other, nor am I the arbiter of what is true, but this is one person's experience. They were assigned to Dutch, and they believed during their FTO period that this was going well. Remember, Dutch told them early on, like, man, there's not a lot for us to do, which communicates a sense of like, cool, I'm doing well then, right? And while Joe says that they were, of course, like there were, of course, moments in like where there was training or where like coaching was applied, they were quite surprised at the end of this to learn at the end of their time with Dutch, that Dutch told their training officer that Joe wasn't ready. Again, you know, I don't know if I can say this more.
Yeah.
There are always two sides. We weren't there, but it's a believable complaint. And it brings a point that I think should be made clear to everyone. And this is the universal experience that, many people have said, which is I was surprised to learn that my FTO didn't think I was like ready.
Oh, that's never a good thing.
No one, hold on.
Yeah.
No one should be surprised at the end of an FTO phase. An FTO's role is to work with both the trainee and their training department or manager to ensure the trainee has the best chance of success. Trainees should not be surprised to learn of deficits or successes. If they are surprised, then you have failed to give them an opportunity to recognize those deficits and to address them. You have failed at your job if they are surprised and you are an FTO. That really is it.
Let's think back to the comments of like, there's not really much more to train you on, you know, like those kind of comments and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost giving the opposite vibes.
Right? Communication should happen regularly and often. And there is, this is a thing from Neil deGrasse Tyson, the science communicator physicist that I really appreciated. He says, when you are a communicator, you are passing a ball to someone else. The ball being the message, right? It is up to you, the person passing the ball, to pass it in a way that the other person can catch it.
Yeah.
And so if you send a message and you're not sure it was received or understood, then it is on you. The onus is on you to make sure that it is understood, to try and find different ways to say it, or to communicate that, so that the other person receives the message and understands the message that you are trying to send. So it may be that Dutch thought, like, well, yeah, they should know that, you know, like, I coached them a little bit and I found that their performance to be unsatisfactory, you know, and so they should be able to kind of read into that. You know, I stopped saying, yeah, there's not a lot for us to do, because suddenly there was stuff for us to do. And how could they not know that then, you know, like, that showed that they weren't improving? I don't know, because you didn't say it the right way. You didn't say it in a way that made sure it was clear. Again, the goal here is that at the end of your FTO training period, no one should be surprised as to the next steps that are taken, right? I don't want to imply that, you know, a trainer's job is to criticize. As a trainer, you need to be able to deliver both good news and bad news. And if you're the type of person who shies away from delivering constructive criticism, which, you know, that is one of the reasons that people are often surprised at the end. They're like, yeah, I think they could have used a little more work, but you didn't say that because you like the person. You didn't want to hurt their feelings. Then you need to dedicate time to learning how to be able to deliver constructive criticism in a way that is empathetic and kind. And it's also saying, like, criticisms aren't all that you offer. You need to be able to promote good behaviors, the things that you want to see repeated. You should acknowledge those and promote those. All of this, if done in the right way, promotes growth, and that's what your goal is. Honesty without empathy is cruelty. So if you are delivering criticisms and you're not considering the other person, then you're being that's just cruelty that you're doing. You're just cutting somebody down.
There's a fine line. I get it, because you can't be the empathy can't be so strong that you cloud the message. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. If you're too nice and you don't give them, then you're not giving them the opportunity to grow either. So right. It's a solid mix. Yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's some people be like, hey, that's a really hard needle to thread. And my response is yes.
Yeah.
Being an FTO is a skill. being an FTO is truly a skill. Being an FTO really, it should not be seen as just like a next step that everybody goes through. And unfortunately, we've over the course of doing this show, we've run into plenty of agencies where culturally they kind of pick FTOs based on like who's been there like the longest, or who's like, you know, well-liked, or, you know, like maybe people that are kind of just looking to advance in their career. Some of those people are really eager to get like authority, you know, that's dangerous. But that's really not the way it should be done. FTO should be seen as a specialty. And so systems should be prioritizing finding folks who enjoy teaching and they understand the importance of empathy alongside with that touch of honesty and other necessities for the job, like system familiarization, medicine, policies, those kind of things. And they really should be, you need to see it as less of a promotional step and more of a special assignment. Think of it like, so there are like flight teams, for example, whereas some of the flight crews hoist, some of them don't. Hoisting is a special assignment. It's an extra skill you do. It's not a promotion. Yeah. And FTO kind of needs to be seen the same. You should be compensated more because you are taking on more of a workload, and it's a great resume builder. But the idea here is that this isn't a next step for everybody to take when they've been there long enough. It's a step for those that are passionate about educating and shaping the next people coming along. And so your FTO selection, I would say, is honestly one of the most important selections that your company will make, because the FTO is going to be building the mold that all your new employees are going to be pressed into as they come in. And so if you fuck up that decision, you're putting salty medics who take shortcuts into those positions, then what you can expect is to get a group of salty medics who take shortcuts from the get-go. You know, we gotta give people some time to develop their saltiness. Let that brine form on their own. we don't need to add it in.
And again, I do want to make the point, just to make sure it's driven home, that Dutch, the interaction here with Dutcher, this is really just a stepping stone to talk to about an issue that I have seen throughout my career. So this is not me picking on Dutch. Again, I don't know that whole, we don't know that relationship. We don't know
what this is. Dutch, exactly. I was there. I'm kidding. No, that does bear. That goes for all of our calls. And here's the thing. We have a lot of listeners who submit calls that we're very grateful for, who are very open and vulnerable and say, hey, I fucked up. I could have done better. And then we do get submissions where it's like, look how great I was in the face of incompetence of everybody else. And people tend to remember things a little bit better in their favor. And so I'm certainly not accusing anybody of that going on today, but I am being realistic in that we're all human and we like to remember our own efforts, a little bit stronger or at least a little more innocent than maybe they are. And so let's just bear in mind that everything we have is a subjective view, from one of many, many different angles on this call. And so, So EMS 2020, it is a place where people can come and be vulnerable and have things picked apart. There's a reason that we change everybody's names and other details is so that people can plausibly say, yeah, they're not talking about me, because it all could be very inaccurate. So anyway, just bear that in mind on the show.
EMS except for Arizona T, that guy, that is his name.
That's his exact name. All right.
Oh, man. Well, let's talk about the pregame. I guess another thing that I think is an opportunity here that was missed.
And stay down on the ground a little bit longer, Dutch. We're not done kicking.
And I will admit, even as an FTO, I have done this when I have been down charts or my the capacity to engage in conversation. Like, it's hard to, when you're just trying to not cry about the 30th call you've got on. Well,
it's not just charts. It's charts and then whatever, like, evaluations you have to write. Like, there's more stuff.
God. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff. So on a busy day, like, I get it when you're like, the only words I will say are fists. And I don't want to do that. Right. Totally understand.
Right. I mean, I get that. Yeah. The reports and everything. But at the end of the day, you know, like the pregame, this is a great moment. This is a great habit to instill at the training level. One thing I will kind of give some credibility for, or maybe not even necessarily credibility, but this is kind of where things are kind of coming out of my expertise in a little bit. I have a lot of habits that I do with trainees that I can see getting stale or losing value after 6 months with the trainee. So like, you know what I mean? Like, a pregame habit, or like a habit of like, you know, one of the things I always like to do is those three questions. And I have the trainee answer first. What went well? What didn't go well? And what would you change next time? Because that does a whole bunch. If you're consistently asking that about every single call, then that whole thing about the trainee knowing where they're at and where they're not at, they'll know because they're updated after every call about exactly what you thought needs to improve, right? There aren't any mysteries. And if there's chronic things, like that's the opportunity to be like, hey, man, this happened again. This happened again. And this opportunity to be like, if we can't fix this, we need to look into, you know, a different job, you know, like not necessarily saying that, but like, or I don't know that I can pass you at the end of the 6 months if you're not fixing these repeated issues. Those are all things that we can do during that time. But after 6 months of running calls in what seems to be at least a giant system, I don't know about a busy system, but that would get pretty stale. I can definitely understand that, but you could at least, relegate it to, like ALS calls or, you know, calls where we expedite or transport, those kind of things. You can do that. But anyway,
sure.
But yeah, let's move on to arrival and assessment. I'll maintain, I like the initial, assessment when they first got in of like, hey, LOC, ABC, like, do we have any immediate life threats that we have to correct now? Urgent cares are really, really good at their field of medicine. Emergency is not their field of medicine.
Yeah.
No, urgency is not emergency.
Yeah. No, that's fair.
I
really don't have any qualms until we get into the interrogation chamber, ambulance. and then I like to say this. You can be wrong or you can be an asshole, but you really should not be both.
Yeah.
At the same time. And so you could be wrong. It's understandable to, you know, like if you're picking up on mannerisms, you're like, this, you know, gentleman has a history of being, you know, a drug user. You know, like, and whatever it is. But, again, that doesn't mean you can be a dick to, somebody or speak in a way that, like, clearly upset this patient, right? Because then he's like, yeah, no, I'm done. So don't do that.
Yeah.
You could be wrong.
The only thing I would kind of say, just sorry to back up a little bit, is I did have one problem before the ambulance is that we started moving the patient towards the ambulance without really knowing anything about him. I think it would have been fine if they moved him to the ambulance and immediately started vital signs. That probably would have been fine. So I guess there's no problem with this if it's done smoothly. It's like, hey, LOC, ABC, great. You guys go ahead and get him in the ambulance, start getting a set of vitals. I'm going to get the rest of the PHI and the history here. Then you're really accomplishing three things at once, right? You're egressing, you're getting PHI, and then at the same time, you know, by the time you get out there, vital signs should be well underway, right?
Yeah, you really got to get that demographics sheet from the
yeah, absolutely, 100%. That's got to be get the CMN
protected sign. Health information.
Yeah. So anyway,
instead of the history of present illness.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, same letters. But anyway, that's I guess that's my 2 points there.
Yeah.
So there you go.
No. I think the only other thing that probably would have been beneficial is to, and I think this is a good thing to do anyway. You know, it's like once you establish that somebody has a stroke, it may not seem worthwhile to do a repeat stroke assessment. I think it still has some utility. You know, like sometimes things get worse and you want to be able to note that they've gotten worse, or sometimes they get better and maybe this is more of a TIA situation. All of these things are still like important to communicate to the hospital. Like, hey, when we found him, he initially, you know, had complete deficits on this side. On a repeat exam, I have seen some improvement. Ultimately, the hospital is still going to be like, yeah, cool, CT scan this guy. But it's still, I think it still has merit to, you know, to demonstrate improvement or, you know, worsening. So, let's talk aphasia.
I mean, can we? Like, is that even possible?
So I'm going to give a bit of the update here, but you'll have to stay for the rest of it. You can't just get out of this, guys.
Okay.
You're in it now. Yeah.
You're right. The patient is having a, and then we'll do the rest later. So go ahead.
So Dutch returned from the CT and got into the ambulance and confirmed that the patient was having a stroke. A follow-up later revealed that the patient had a total occlusion of the M1 branch of their left middle cerebral artery. There it
is.
I'm not having
a
stroke.
That'd be a hell of a stroke. It's blocking the coronary artery, but stroke-like symptoms. All right.
Middle coronary.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was happening with this patient with this presentation? Yeah. Well, yes, you are not wrong. So I want to talk about a condition called Broca's aphasia or expressive aphasia. And I'm going to simplify all of this probably to the point of oversimplification where there's going to be some people going like, yeah, but no, because I like to keep things as kind of a broad overview and not get into the like super nitty gritty. There are some nitty gritty. Everything is gray. It's medicine. Here we go. So when it comes to language centers in the brain, we primarily have two already. Oversimplification. We have Wernicke's area and Broca's area. Broca's area in the brain is fed by the middle cerebral artery and the superior branches off of that artery. So like M1. Broca's area is primarily thought to deal with speech production. So speaking words in a fluent manner, and fluency is like non-choppiness. So not stuttering, not adding ums, like, and everyone experiences some like disfluency, as it's called. Like I'm a disfluent person. I speak in stuttering and ums, and I hate it too. But
I mean, it gives me something to do as an editor. Yeah. But yeah, aside from that,
it's not a great trait for a podcaster. But here we are. So, and you know what? Successful so far.
That's the best part. Is you and I suck at this in a lot of ways, but somehow we're killing it, and I don't get it. Anyway.
Yeah. So, knowing what we know about Broca's area because of basically the very little information that I've given you, what we know is that when there is an injury or an insult to Broca's area, what we see is that the ability to to understand language, like to receive messages, is largely retained. But the problem is that their ability to speak or write out words is impacted. So they'll have difficulty speaking. They can have trouble just like forming the words or even finding the right words to say. And they may even exhibit something called paraphasia, where they substitute one word for another. And there's kind of two types of this. There can be semantic. So you're switching a word for one that you can't think of for one that has similar context. So like, if you're trying to talk about the couch, you may say cushion instead, because cushion has an association with couch, and contextually they're similar, right? Or you can have phonetic paraphasia, where you substitute one word that has a similar sound. So you might say ohm instead of home.
Gotcha. But,
yeah. So that is a lot of what you see here. And
or banana instead of chair. Yeah. Wait.
What?
Anyway, go ahead.
No, I'm good. Hey, I want you to lift your arms for me.
Yeah.
Okay. Knowing that, now we can contrast. Like, Wernicke's area deals with the comprehension of language. Injuries to this area impact a patient's ability to understand spoken or written language and speak in a coherent manner. Now, the interesting thing here is that a patient with an intact Broca's area but an injured Wernicke's area may not understand written or spoken speech, but they will be able to speak fluently, albeit incomprehensibly, in word salad. So, in other words, they won't have that like stuttering or trying to find the right words. They may not exhibit that like dysarthria, where like the, you know, like they're, and dysarthria is more of like a motor issue, right? Like dysarthria is the difficulty speaking and swallowing. And a lot of that is because like, hey, you know, like the nerves that control that are impacted. And so like patients can have trouble like with the facial droop, right? Yeah. That's different from the Broca's area piece, where it's the trying to get words then to the motor center, if I'm understanding this correctly. If somebody has just an impacted Wernicke's area but an intact Broca's area, they'll be able to speak fluently. They'll be able to speak in non-stuttering or broken sentences. It's going to be garbage. It's going to be nonsensical. I get to use the word neologism, which is somebody said that to us the other day. And I was like, well, I have to look this up. And now I get to use it. So thank you, person, for sending that. And that is essentially like, hey, they have made up a whole word entirely. So the interesting thing here is that And the key part about this thing is like the Wernicke's aphasia is that the patient won't realize that they're not making sense. They think they're making sense. So any frustration they may have is really because you aren't understanding and they think that they are communicating very clearly, nor are they understanding what you are saying. So, it's very, this is a very interesting thing. And by the way, Wernicke's area is supplied by the distal branches of the middle cerebral artery, which brings us to, okay, so what happens if the entire middle cerebral artery is occluded? Well, then you could have global aphasia, which is the worst of all outcomes. And it's actually really the most devastating. This is a large vessel occlusion, right? Then you'll have global aphasia where the person can't really speak and they can't understand you at all, nor would they be able to write out or read written things, because Wernicke's area also is the interpretation of written language.
Which actually starts to make sense why some of his handwriting was okay and some of it wasn't.
Yeah, because this patient's trying to find the right words, and that part of the brain that gives them that isn't able to. Again, guys, this topic gets really deep, and it is really interesting. I think the important thing to recognize here is that the brain is just a very complex structure, and damage to particular structures or areas, even small ones, can have some profound effects. For instance, some strokes can impair structures that impact a patient's ability to repeat words that they hear, but overall, mostly preserving their ability to speak and comprehend. Or you have patients who can repeat words fluently when they, like you say, hey, say this, they can say it back, but they have no idea what you are saying or what they are saying. They're just able to repeat it. It's incredibly complex. And I think ultimately all of this brings us to the point here, like, yes, alcohol and drugs can definitely impair a person's ability to communicate. No one is doubting that. Like, Dutch and Arizona are not wrong to think like, hey, maybe this is a thing, because it could be a thing. But as Chris said earlier, the order of operations matters. The is it broken is above the is it intoxicated, and for good reason. And I think it's really important that EMTs and paramedics, and I do include EMTs on this, we need to become familiar with the variety of ways that strokes can present so that we can do what Joe did and investigate further when we are kind of like, hey, this could be a stroke. Let's explore the boundaries of what this patient can or cannot do. And let's see if we can uncover a few more stones. And this is why I picked this call, is that I think Joe did a remarkable job kind of picking up the hint of a thread here and then coming up with a really strong way of assessing that further and making it very clear that this patient was having a stroke. So that's why I bring this all up.
It was super commendable on Joe's. The other thing I want to add to Joe's part in this is that Joe also had to push uphill a little bit too. And when you're a trainee, that can be difficult when you're going against the clear direction of your FTO. And maybe that does lean some credibility back to Dutch a little bit, in the sense that, you know, he did have an FTO, or he did have a trainee that felt that was an okay thing to do. So
yeah,
could be that Dutch is creating a collaborative environment where the trainee feels empowered to say what they want to do, even if it does come with a snarky reply. I absolutely agree with that. What do you think about in ways of treatments for this guy?
I have
my thoughts.
I think, you know, you got the 18 gauge left AC, you drew some blood. He didn't need a correction of, you know, like any blood sugar issues. The patient wasn't in pain or nauseous to our knowledge. So I think he got the big things.
So one thing I would include in treatment is transport decision. And so I kind of want to go back to talking about the transport decision just a little bit.
Yeah.
So he was initially en route to French Press, and French Press came back and said, hey, we're on red. Now, I want to be very clear. Different areas are going to have different rules about what divert means, you know, and what can and can't be done. Also, if it's a VA hospital, the rules will change. However, generally speaking, depending on the hospital's capabilities and what they're doing, especially if they're a specialty resource such as a stroke center or a trauma center, being on divert doesn't necessarily mean you can't go there. If you have a critical time, time critical patient, you're still going to go there. That's the case of where Spencer and I used to work on ground is that if you have a patient and they're, you know, you got a code, for example, and your nearest hospital is 5 minutes away, if they're on divert, too bad. They're going to get the patient. And I know that flies in the face of reality sometimes because it's like, okay, what bed would you like them to go in? Cause there are none, those kind of things. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it very well could be because you can say, well, you're supposed to leave one open. Okay. Then you get a coded patient next one. What about the next coded patient? You know, like it's, what if they get two codes and you only left one bed open? What if they get five codes and there's four beds?
Double
open?
Code.
You know? Yeah. Exactly. Like kick someone out to a hallway. I don't know, you know, so yeah, I mean, I admit the policy has some that has, there are times where it will collide with reality. So. What I do recommend is, hey, we're on divert. Tell them what you have. Yeah. And a couple things can change. This is where we get to make some calls in the field, as long as your policy allows for these kind of judgment calls. I remember specifically making a judgment call, actually, and then I think a friend of the show, Q, actually made a very similar judgment call once. And it was, hey, I have a STEMI patient. And they came back and they're like, and they were actually green, but they came back and they said, hey, we have another STEMI patient right now. We can't see this, you know, like we're not gonna be able to see your STEMI patient for, you know, another 20 minutes after they get here. So or they're not, yeah. the door to balloon time is going to be delayed by at least 20 minutes when they get here. So I can't, like, they're not going to tell me no, they can't. Okay.
Yeah.
But they're giving me information to make a better decision. And so I went to a technically farther away hospital with a technically sooner door to balloon time, because that's what matters. I think oftentimes we get hospitalitis and we tend to believe that, hey, once they're off my stretcher and I've yeeted them through the doors of an ER, everything is golden. And that kind of applies here a bit too. So you have someone goes, hey, we're on divert. Instead of saying, okay, disregard, come back and say, hey, I have a stroke scale. You know, I have someone who's a positive stroke patient. You know, they kind of go back to them that way. And they may come back and say, hey, like we've already got one right now. Our team is doing that person, so.
Or our CT scanner is down, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Different capabilities. And so in this case, when someone comes up and says, hey, we can't accept this patient or, you know, we're on red, it's always kind of good to come back and say like, hey, and again, I don't know what the rules of your area are. But even if, let's say, even if they can refuse a patient if they're red, let's say your local area hospital rules are that way, come back on and be like, hey, totally understand that. What I have is I have a stroke patient. And if you guys are able, you know, to get him to intervention, then that would be that. That's what he needs. And they may be able to like, okay, yeah, my ER is absolutely booked, but he's not going to the ER. He's going to go to CT, then he's going to go to the cath lab, and then he's going to go to the neuro ICU, you know? So depending on the patient you have, they may avoid the ER entirely. And so the ER status may not actually be a problem in this case. So just bear that in mind, especially when you have a specialty transfer like this, that may require specialty services. That would be one extra little bonus tip that I'd add in there. BLS.
Yeah. So I think outside of the IV, in terms of, you know, the good treatments decisions that happened here, outside of the IV, I think this perfectly applicable to BLS level providers.
Yeah.
And I know if that
you're, sorry, go ahead.
And I know that, like, you know, I recall being an EMT and not kind of getting a really solid foundation of strokes. You know, it's kind of like you look for facial droop and, you know, unilateral weakness. Or, you know, arm drift or, you know, paralysis. But again, I think a lot of stroke, assessment tools have recognized, speech to be a bigger part and include more aspects of speech. So I think this is a perfectly reasonable thing for, you know, BLS patients to catch as well. ALS doesn't, pen and pencil doesn't belong to ALS. Right. So you can do this. Yeah.
That's not too advanced. We've said on the show many, many times is that for the most part, with very few exceptions, like interpreting 12 leads, there are very few assessments that are precluded from the EMT scope. So it's all on the table for you. And so with this patient, I agree. This is an IVO2 monitor transport patient. That's really what they are. To the point that unless you have cause for concern with airway compromise, you know, specifically look for things like nausea. Are they not protecting their own airway, in and out of consciousness? I don't know what the value of an ALS intercept for this one would be. I would say that even though this is clearly an ALS patient and they're, you know, clearly having a stroke, I think in this case, time to intervention, what this patient needs, extraction of that clot, is going to be or clotbuster therapy is going to be paramount. And I think that would be best handled by just heading to the hospital. I don't necessarily see an ALS intervention that's going to improve this patient's outcome at this juncture.
Yep.
So anyway, all right. But you said there was a part two to the follow-up.
Yeah. Earl Greyhot had a thrombectomy. And
okay.
Yeah. So they went up to a cath lab. They just went and sucked that clot right out.
The coffee straw.
Yeah. There was some concern about using clot-busting medication like TNK, given the patient's history of IV drug use, because then it's a question of like, okay, you know, like, what do they call it when, like, when stuff grows in the body because of IV, like, typically IV drug use. Like, there's a little, like
indwelling
fungi.
Bacteria?
Yeah, like bacteria or like little
cultures
that can, yeah, cultures that can, can, you know,
like a colony
for
colonized bacteria,
like, or just like fungus, vegetation that can grow on like the heart valves and stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah. Those can break off and create little emboli. And those, that's a very different thing. You know, like TNK doesn't destroy the septic emboli, it breaks down clots. So if that wasn't in fact a thromboembolic stroke and it was in fact like due to some kind of vegetative embolic stroke or septic stroke, then all you're doing is they still have the stroke and now you've just made it so that they can bleed easier. So they decided not to do that, and they went directly to just pulling that clot out, and it went well. They did it
good.
They found 100% occlusion of the left main or middle cerebral artery, the M1 branch, the first branch off of it. And yeah, the patient ended up having a full recovery.
All right, strong work.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, hey, hats off to Joe. Alrighty, guys. Well, thank you for listening to yet another episode of EMS 2020. Please be sure to check out flightbridgeed.com. Head it over to the bookstore and check out the Advanced Concepts in Critical Care book. It is on pre-sale now. It's going to ship on the 20th. You can save 15% if you get your copy now, and you'll get a limited author-signed pre-release copies while supplies last for those. I need to make sure that is while supplies last. So there you go. With that, I want to thank our other sponsors for the day, and that is going to be Jump Medic. Jumpmedic.com. Head on over there. Get yourself one of the absolutely best premium first aid kits that you could possibly have. I have one. It lives in my truck. I have a Pro Gen 2. I really need to get a Pro Gen 3. But yeah, check out jumpmedic.com. Use promo code EMS2020. And we will...
I also have one. It lives in Chris's house, though, for some
it
reason.
It does. Actually, he's not even lying. It's at my feet right now. I'm looking at it. I think I would put two in my truck. Anyway, actually, I don't have a truck anymore. I have an SUV. All right, everyone, thanks again for listening. There's an announcement soon. There's an announcement soon. There you go. That's what you get to know. There's an announcement soon. All right, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been a production of Long Pause Media, a division of Flightbridge Ed, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.